dark side of the Force is a pathway to many abilities some consider to be unnatural.
Is it possible to learn this power?
Not from a Jedi.
The Council wants you to report on all the Chancellor's dealings.
That's treason.
We are at war, Anakin.
Very dangerous putting them together. I don't think the boy can handle it. I don't trust him.
I need your help, son.
I'm appointing you to be my personal representative on the Jedi Council.
You're on this council, but we do not grant you the rank of master.
What?
Obi-Wan and the council don't trust me.
Learn to know the dark side of the Force, and you will achieve a power greater than any Jedi.
You're under arrest, Chancellor.
Are you threatening me, Master Jedi? Every single Jedi is now an enemy of the Republic. Do what must be done. Do not hesitate. Show no mercy.
Who could have done this?
Twisted by the dark side, young Skywalker has become.
I feel so helpless.
You are the chosen one!
This podcast is sponsored in part by Benjamin Hart.
That's me!
And yours truly, Zach Arnold.
And by participation from listeners like you. So let's tune in to another episode of...
IPC.
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 The Intergalactic Peace Coalition Podcast.
All the galaxies.
All for you.
Why, hello there, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to the Intergalactic Peace Coalition podcast, also known as the IPC, and we are broadcasting live right here on channel 1138.com, but also coming to you via iTunes and Google Play, and of course our good friends over at the Star Wars Underworld, which some one of them actually happens to be me, I'm just throwing it out there, they let us host on their site, and we couldn't be happier. And you can also listen and stream on that site and wherever, and of course ipcpodcast.podbean.com is our host site, and this is episode number 238, and tonight we're going to be breaking down another Star Wars film. Yeah, we've had enough of Marvel. We did 4 hours last week on Endgame and our 5-year anniversary, and it was a lot of fun. We're going to keep it a bit shorter tonight and talk about Star Wars Episode III, Revenge of the Sith. And it's going to be a lot of fun. We're in the lead up to Star Wars Episode IX, The Rise of Skywalker, coming later this year. We're reviewing almost every single Star Wars movie in the lead-up to that movie. But before we get into the movie tonight, introductions are in order if you are new to the program. Of course, my name is Ben, and joining me, as he always does, his equipment tried to keep him away, but he just fought back like a trooper, and he's here tonight. It's my good buddy, Mr. Zach Arnold.
Dude, it seems like every time we try and do something on time or early, my computer or a function on my computer is like, haha, sorry, that ain't gonna happen. And I'm just like, oh, brother. Because actually, we probably should have been on the air at least an hour ago, and it's just now happening. So I feel terrible, but I also feel really excited and really prepared to talk about this movie, because believe it or not, I actually had time in my schedule to sit down and watch an entire movie from beginning to end.
You did better than I did. I did not get a chance. Shamefully did not get a chance. Of course, I mean, I've seen it 1,000 times already, so that's kind of ingrained in my brain. But yeah, this movie is great. It's great. And I'm glad you got a chance to watch it, because it's been a little while for me too.
It was really nice to just sit down and rewatch the film and see certain things that maybe I'd forgotten or didn't realize they emphasized quite as much as they did. But there's a lot to kind of break down about this film. And I didn't think it was appropriate for us to talk about a Star Wars movie without bringing in another Star Wars fan. And we've done this pretty regularly with our other Star Wars discussions, and this guy just happens to be probably the biggest Revenge of the Sith fan that I know. And so it's only fitting that we bring him in, and it's doubly sweet because he's also a co-host over on another podcast that I'm part of called Call the Banners, a Game of Thrones podcast. We're really excited to have him back for more fun, this time from the galaxy far, far away. It's Mr. Sean Giroux.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here. Love Revenge of the Sith, and I mean, absolutely love it. Like Ben, I didn't get time to watch the full thing, so
really,
I cheated.
Really? Only one?
I decided to watch all 5 lightsaber battles and figured that's good enough.
You got a good chuck of it there.
But no, I'm stoked. And I mean, I've seen this movie well over 100 times. And hey, as long as we don't start a bunch of fan petitions, I'm game for this tonight.
Yeah, no petitions, no nothing about that. No talking about remaking the prequels. Nuh-uh, we ain't doing that. No.
And no conspiracy theories about how Kit Fisto isn't really dead.
But
pretty
but Zach,
dead to me.
I don't know. Did you see a body? I don't know. Maybe he was. I don't know.
I'm really not getting into that. It's kind of an inside joke here on IPC. We talked about it on last week's episode. If you want to be able to try and endure all 4-something hours, then by all means, give it a shot so you can understand
endure.
That
endure? How dare you? It's called enjoy.
Man, when I am talking for longer than 30 minutes, it's an endurance.
Okay, fun fact, that episode was not done in one sitting. We did it in 2 parts over 2 nights. It was nuts, but it was multiple
parts of those 2 nights as well.
You're right.
Because we were like taking breaks and stuff. I think it was spread out over like 3 or 4 parts or something like that. And I didn't realize what the final cut was going to be until you told me. And I was like, holy crap.
Had no idea. Oh, and by the way, it was really late. Apologies for that. Literally released it yesterday because it was so hard to get it together in the edit. But yeah, it's a good episode. Go listen to it. And you're going to get 2 this week.
Hopefully this one will be a little bit easier to put together and easier to listen to, because it's just one movie and it's one movie revisited, and yep, it's one pretty action heavy movie. When we talked about Attack of the Clones, we talked about how there was a lot of character development, a lot of plot building. There is that element, obviously, as you're watching Anakin's downfall, but Sage, is it fair to say that Revenge of the Sith probably has the most action out of any of the Star Wars movies that we've gotten, either from the first 6 or either of the new 2 ones, or 4 new ones as well?
I don't even think it's close, man. I think when you look at it, you can probably take 2 and or even 3 other Star Wars movies, combine them together, and you don't get the amount of action that's in this movie. You just don't. It's all over the place in this movie. And, you know, from the first time I saw it to, you know, rewatching it years and years later, it holds up. I'm totally okay with the amount of action in this movie.
It's a thrill ride in and of itself, because I mean, this movie from the get-go has so much to do, and I'm not gonna sit here and be, you know, super negative about the prequels, but they do have their faults. I think one of them is the fact that Phantom Menace, Attack of the Clones don't do a whole lot to like advance the plot of these films too much. Like, yeah, the Clone Wars is a big deal. You get that at the tail end of Attack of the Clones. For the most part, you know, Revenge of the Sith comes in and you're having a lot of stuff that happens between 2 and 4, and you got to wrap all this stuff up and put it in there. So you know, you're having, and then you're on top of that just having all these kind of crazy stuff that's happening. It opens with, you know, the kidnapping of Chancellor Palpatine and the Battle of Coruscant. Some of the, my, I think Revenge of the Sith still has the best opening of any Star Wars film. I don't know if it'll ever be topped.
Ooh, okay. I'm really torn because I did absolutely love that sequence. And I think the thing that I loved the most about it was after watching the Clone Wars, you know, you see these types of ships in the Clone Wars, and they have some fantastic action sequences in the animated TV series. But to see it brought to life that grand of a fashion was definitely eye candy. However, there is still something to be said about the iconic nature of Vader's Star Destroyer coming over the top of the camera in A New Hope. Like, that's still some of the best camera work and tone setting of any movie that I've ever seen. I really enjoyed both of those.
Yeah, I think 3 and 4 up there is the best openings. And I know there's more subtle ones that are good. I love Empires, you know. But Revenge of the Sith is just this... It's just massive, and it's just this grand scale, and it's really, like, everything you wanted from the Clone War. Like, this thing we've heard about for so long. We got a taste of it at the end of Attack of the Clones, and you really see it full force in this film right off the bat.
The main thing that I ended up thinking about was, how amazing would it be if we got certain arcs, or even just certain episodes, those of the Clone Wars made to look like what we see in Revenge of the Sith.
I'm telling you, that stuff in Season 7 is looking pretty darn realistic. I'm just going to say.
Oh, without a doubt. I'm not trying to discredit anything that they're currently making, but, you know, if you're making The Mandalorian, if you're making a Cassian series, I would be really interested in seeing maybe, like, the Umbara arc or something like that being put to live action.
I mean, the Umbara arc is basically a movie in and of itself. Like, it's just a movie into four parts. Like, you could easily just stitch it together and then also turn it into live action. It would be great.
I don't know, Sage, if there was something that was made in the style of that opening sequence of Revenge of the Sith, what material from the Clone Wars would you pull from?
I don't know if I'd pull any of them, being honest. I think the and maybe I'm not totally understanding what you're asking, but for me, the beginning of Revenge of the Sith is perfect. And to echo some of the thoughts a little bit earlier, I think the later seasons of the Clone Wars, maybe not so much the lost seasons, but seasons 4 and 5 specifically, have a real Revenge of the Sith feel to them in terms of the opening sequence all the way up to the Dooku battle.
It's very true. Very true.
Yeah. So transitioning out of that really quick, I just want to say, you know, to your point, like, I've heard a lot of people talk about over the years how that opening sequence in Revenge of the Sith plays a lot like an episode of Clone Wars, because it's just this kind of almost one-off adventure, but at the same time, it is playing into the overall plot, and you get, you know, great banter between Obi-Wan and Anakin, which we kind of were starved of for a lot of the prequels, and then getting into the whole thing with the Chancellor and him being kidnapped, and then, you know, basically, I love the brilliance of that opening scene is it leads up to them rescuing Palpatine, and it ultimately, even unbeknownst to Anakin, is this passing of the torch from Dooku to Anakin to become the next Sith. And he's basically, you know, killing his predecessor as a Sith would do. He's just not a Sith yet.
Well, I think Obi-Wan's assessment was also pretty spot on. Later on in the movie, he talks about how after the death of Dooku, Anakin became his new apprentice. We watch Anakin's story as he gradually devolves into that, or evolves, however you would want to look at it. But as he gradually makes his way to that over the course of the movie, we see it transpire. But for somebody like Obi-Wan, for all he knew, you know, he might have killed Dooku, and then while Obi-Wan was unconscious, he just decided to embrace the darkness and became Palpatine's apprentice right there. He'd just been fooling everyone ever since then. It's not entirely outside of the realm of possibility, because much like, I can't believe I'm about to say this, but much like a child predator is towards their targets, Palpatine has been molding him and shaping him for a long time, and the payoff finally transpired in this movie, starting with Dooku's execution.
Yeah, yeah. I don't I don't know, Palpatine, is he a perv? Yeah, kind of. Like, he's just a creepy old man.
I mean, he literally put his shoulder on Anakin at the end of The Phantom Menace. He's like, we will watch your career with great interest.
Yeah. Yeah, ugh. He's definitely
away from me, Grandpa.
He's definitely been reeling him in all this time, and this is his moment. One of my favorite moments of that entire sequence is where Palpatine goads Anakin into killing Dooku and says, oh yeah, you know, do it, kill him. Anakin doesn't want to do it, because Anakin at this point is still a pretty good person. He's trying to do his best, and then Palpatine immediately, as soon as Anakin does it, goes, you did well. And, you know, I understand why you wanted to do it, because he cut off your arm. And he's, like, putting that on Anakin immediately. Like, saying, like, yeah, you wanted to do it. And it's like, Anakin didn't even want to, like, go through with it. Like, you know, he was saying, like, that's not the Jedi way. But that's the whole manipulation with Palpatine, is that he's just, at this point, he's like, okay, I'm finally going to start making my move. And I love reading the novelization, too, because it goes into detail about, like, Dooku thought it was going to go a completely different way. Like, he thought it was going to be, they were going to reveal themselves to Anakin and all this kind of stuff. And next thing you know, he loses his head.
I mean, I know we're talking about the movie, but really quickly here, if you guys haven't read the novel, you need to read the novel Revenge of the Sith, because it shows that from Dooku's perspective, his death.
Yeah.
And it's just written so fantastically in terms of, you know, what he's thinking towards Palpatine / Sidious at that moment. It's beautiful.
It is. I just read it recently. It's great.
I mean, if you're looking at it, not even if you haven't read the novelization like I haven't, you see the look on Christopher Lee's face in that sequence that is just dread and horror, because he's like, wait a second, you're supposed to be my master. You're supposed to look out for me. You're supposed to tell this dude to arrest me, you know, something like that. And then he's looking at him going, wait, This is how you tell me that my services are no longer required? You're not just terminating my employment, you're terminating my life. Like, that sense of dread. But the interesting thing is, he could have had the opportunity to rat Palpatine out.
Yeah.
He had a split second there before Anakin, you know, split the blades, where he could have blurted something out and been like, Palpatine's a Sith Lord! Just to try and save his head. But he didn't.
That changes the whole movie there. It really does if he does that.
Well, that's the thing, is he was so devoted to his master, he was willing to take that secret to the grave.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Even crazier is the fact that one Mr. Binks is still serving on the Senate.
It's so sad that... I know Jar Jar had an arc in the prequels. I know he was going to have a bigger role. And I know George cut it back because of the backlash. And he's just there, and he gets one line in this movie, and then he's gone. Line.
Poor Ahmed, like, best.
God, man, like, he would have been like... And he has, like, there's a whole scene in Revenge of the Sith where, you know, there was a cut scene, I don't think it's ever been released, where Palpatine's talking to Jar Jar, and he's like, ah, you've done well, and, you know, Jar Jar, he's got him, like, wrapped around his finger, like, he's been manipulating Jar Jar this whole time, and we get none of that in this movie. It's sad.
Oh,
I mean, once people heard that George had other plans for Jar Jar, there was conversation at one point that it was actually Jar Jar who was Darth Plagueis.
I think everyone's been Darth Plagueis at some point.
It's like this era's Snoke theories, but it was just so funny to think about how if the tragedy of Darth Plagueis hadn't been a tragedy, it was just, have you ever heard of Darth Plagueis the Wise? And he can do all these things that he talks about when he's sitting down with Anakin, and it turns out the one being in the universe who can do all those things is Darth Binks. Like, I don't know. That would have been a kick-ass plot twist. But I digress just a little bit. I think the Falcon got a better cameo than Jar Jar did. Let's be honest.
Got more screen time, I think.
Probably did. Like,
I don't know. Jar Jar's featured pretty prominently at the funeral at the end.
You're right. He does get some time.
I guess I never really paid that much attention, because by the point we get to the funerals and all that sort of stuff, I'm pretty much emotionally spent. And I'm just kind of like curling up in the fetal position going, aah! And I'm not really looking at the details anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, that whole, you know, that whole ending is so emotional. And this whole movie is emotional. Like, this whole movie, there's so much that happens. And I think in retrospect, we kind of forget, like, this is a huge film and it just changes everything. Like, if you were watching all these movies in order, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, like, Revenge of the Sith, where everything goes down. Like, everything. Like, the whole thing changes. Not only, I mean, you're getting the deaths of characters that have been, you know, staples for the past three films, and now they're gone. Like, Mace Windu, I mean, all the Jedi. Like, it's insane the amount of work. Like, this is the Game of Thrones. This is the Game of Thrones episode of Star Wars movies.
Man, I'm still not ready for Sunday. I'm not.
I have nothing to say about that because
I know there's nothing that you can say. I was hoping to get some kind of reaction from Sage, but I think he was taking a sip of water or something.
I was. Ben's sitting there like, sign the petitions.
Just say something. Anything.
Let me put it this way. There is no petition I would ever sign to replace Revenge of the Sith. Revenge of the Sith is just so over the top awesome and my favorite experience ever in a movie theater too. So
it's funny you should mention that. This, until The Force Awakens, this was the only Star Wars movie I ever saw in the theaters.
Really?
I never made it to Attack of the Clones. I was too young, really, for The Phantom Menace to, like, get anything out of it, and so my parents didn't take me. But yeah, Revenge of the Sith, up until The Force Awakens, that was the only... Okay, unless you want to count the live-action Clone Wars movie, but I don't.
I didn't even go that one.
I mean, I did, but only because, like, a friend of mine bought my ticket for me. Like, I didn't even do it on my own accord. But that was the only one that I really, like, went and saw on the big screen, and I remember feeling so cool. And this is going to date me a little bit. You guys might groan just a wee bit. But this was the first time I saw a PG-13 movie when I was under the age of 13.
Oh.
And I felt like a badass.
How dare you?
I was probably under 13, too. Probably. I can't remember. But I remember that was a big deal, man. That was a huge deal back in the day when, you, oh my goodness, felt. we're getting a Star Wars movie that's PG-13. This is rad. And now all of them are PG-13.
Yeah, because I feel like in the last decade, the term PG-13 has kind of become more of the cultural norm. Like, you don't see a lot of PG movies anymore.
No, you do not. You look up, like, on a yearly basis how many PG movies we get. Very few.
I mean, I think Frozen 2 is going to be PG.
And that's about it. Like, all the Disney movies, the animated Disney movies, I don't even know, like, is Lion King and Aladdin, are they PG? Or PG-13, I wonder.
No, Lion King is G, actually.
Really? I mean, the new live action one.
Oh, the new. Oh, okay. No, I have no clue. I would imagine PG, because that's what I'm pretty sure that's what Beauty and the Beast and the Jungle Book were.
Okay. All right.
I thought you meant like the 90s films for a second there, and I was like, dude.
I know those are those things. Okay, Aladdin is rated PG. The new Aladdin.
Okay.
So They're keeping it family friendly. Good on them. Good on them. Not that PG-13 isn't family friendly, because as we're saying, like, you know, well, it's just the new norm. It's the, you know, graphic violence. Like, they didn't, you know, PG, you know, in 2005 wouldn't allow for this kind of stuff, you know, thing. But, like, I don't know. Revenge of the Sith is a pretty, it's a dark film. It's Revenge of the Sith. It's dark. It's dark side, but at the same time, it's got a lot of violence and stuff like that that you don't see anywhere else. Like, I still think it's the most violent Star Wars film we've gotten in regards to, like, literally heads rolling and people getting their, you know, the heads chopped off, and the implication of children being murdered. Like, it's dark stuff.
Someone burning alive.
Yeah, like the whole scene with Anakin, like that is intense. And you really don't get anything like that. There's some other stuff, and even the new films have gone into some darker areas. You know, Darth Vader hallway scene, that's pretty messed up.
That was cool.
But nothing like Revenge of the Sith. I still like will caution people, like when they're showing their kids Star Wars, I'm like, yeah, maybe wait till they're a little older, show them Revenge of the Sith, because it's you know, thing. And I'm not knocking the movie. I think this movie had to think, like, for example, the youngling scene, like, people draw that. It's been memed so much, we've been desensitized to it, but ultimately it's a very dark scene. But you needed that. You needed to understand that Anakin had fallen so far that he was willing to do that.
Which is such an ironic, or I don't know if I would call it ironic, but just it's so interesting to observe the dickering and the bantering that goes on when they're rescuing the Chancellor,
mm-hmm.
all the way to the arguing that transpires during their climactic fight at the end of the movie. Things just completely dissolve, turn so damn sour in a matter of days, weeks, if that. I mean, what's the timeline for Revenge of the Sith anyway?
I think a few days at most. Maybe a week.
No, it's more than that, because Padme's not showing that much at the beginning of the film, and she's very heavily pregnant at the end of the film.
But he's been away for a while.
Yeah, I think and they said he's been away for like 8 months.
So if she's been pregnant all that time, she'd have to be close by the time he gets back. So I don't know how that timeline works.
I always thought Revenge of the Sith took place over 2 or 3 weeks.
It might. I mean, you never really know. Like, it's only the sequel films that, like, seem to show, like, everything happens within, like, 2 days. Like, it's everything else is kind of ambiguous as far as, like, how long it takes.
Don't tell Game of Thrones fans this. You'll get petitions. Things are moving too quickly. George doesn't like it.
But I think it makes more sense in regards to the plot of this movie that it takes place over a week or a month or something like that. But it's in, you know, but it's presented in that, you know, this is a 2 hour something movie. Like, it moves pretty quick, and you're starting with the movie literally Obi-Wan, Anakin are best friends. They're the team that we've always heard about. They're the Jedi heroes. And you literally end with, you know, Obi-Wan having pretty much almost killed Anakin, and Anakin screaming he hates him from the bottom of a volcano. Like, it's a turnaround.
I gotta go back to the show notes, or I'm just gonna be jumping all over the place. Another happy landing transpires only because Grievous kind of sabotages the bridge. And this is like the first time out of all the times that they've had close encounters over the course of however long they've been at war with each other, a couple of years, Grievous and Anakin have never met until that moment.
Yep.
General Grievous, you're shorter than I expected. Like, oh man.
I just love that they held to that through the entirety of Clone Wars.
Yeah, it really, that really could have been one that that could have been like retconned or you know, could have been more banter that's like, oh, we actually have met each other, but we're pretending like we haven't, or something like that.
Because it's not like it's a big deal in that scene. It's just they're ribbing each other, basically, with these really bad jokes. I was expecting someone with your reputation to be a little older. And Anakin's like, oh, you're shorter than I expected. Like, just really, you know, really lame retort. And, like, it's not a huge deal, but that, to those two lines are just like this huge big deal. We have to be, you know, on thing. They can't meet before this moment.
You come close on Naboo when they make the prisoner exchange, but neither of them are conscious when it happens.
Right, that's the closest. Well, actually, Grievous is conscious, but he doesn't, like, they, like, drag Anakin over. So, it's they skirted the line as far as they could with that one.
Came dangerously close, but you know, one of the most underrated things about that scene, in my opinion, is the look on Ian McDiarmid's face throughout the entire landing procedure. Because he just had his apprentice executed, and he hadn't yet converted Anakin to the dark side. If that landing hadn't gone smoothly, it would have wiped out the Sith. And you can just tell this extreme relief washing over the Chancellor's face. And I feel like it's doubly because the Chancellor of the Senate is safe, but also because the legends and history of the Sith are also safe. Like, he's got this wiping of the brow type of expression that's like, oh, crap, I could have died from that.
Yeah, that whole sequence with Palpatine pretending to be helpless and all this kind of stuff and not drawing on his power that you know he has is the best.
He definitely has a sense of humor, that's for sure.
Well, they all do. That's what's interesting about this movie is they find ways to, you know, rib each other or mess with each other. You know, like you said about things being memed a lot, I feel like Revenge of the Sith probably gets memed more than any episode.
I think it has the most memes.
I really think it does, because one of the internet's other favorite ones is, hello there. it gets used so much. One of the ones that I saw was, it was like Obi-Wan, and then the background was like an Italian restaurant or something like that. And then Grievous, instead of lightsabers coming off of his arms, the caption underneath it reads, several cannoli.
Yeah, I've seen that one, yeah.
I was like, how? How do you stretch that so far that you get General Kenobi and several cannoli to rhyme and make sense? It's just, the internet is a very strange but also very wonderful place.
I want to take a second to address what happens after the crash landing. And not to join the group of millions of complainers out there right now, but I think Revenge of the Sith, and more specifically Attack of the Clones, get a lot of criticism for the amount of green screen used. And it's painfully obvious in the scene following the crash landing with Bail and Jar Jar and Anakin and Padme. It's terribly obvious that they're shooting this all on green screen and there's very little stage there. And it, you know, it pops its ugly head up a few times during this movie that I noticed just watching the lightsaber battles today, and it's standing out more and more the more time we have from the movie's initial release. And yet I sit there and I go, you know, they built a lot more practical sets for The Phantom Menace than they did the following two movies. And it kind of shows, in my opinion. And I wish George and company would have taken a little more time to build some more practical pieces in front of the green screen. Yeah, it's more money, but it makes it look better, in my opinion.
Yeah, I've heard one of the biggest models they ever created for Star Wars, at least at that time, was the lava flow.
Yeah, I heard Mustafar was mostly practical, and then the action shots were kind of CGI'd in, but a lot of the big overarching panning shots and things like that, there was a little bit of effort in that sequence, but most everything else, it did feel like a lot of screens. Because, I mean, Order 66, pretty much all of Order 66 is green screened in one way or another.
Well, and I mean, my problem is not even Mustafar. I think Mustafar looks fantastic because they did use a lot of sets for Mustafar, and they did build the lava sequence there. They actually built the the stone pieces that it goes over out of styrofoam. I remember watching that. I think it's within a minute. But like Order 66, like I think it was about to say it. It's painfully noticeable. Most of the Coruscant shots are painfully noticeable, and I love Coruscant. And I still think you can do Coruscant without it being all CG. I just feel like they maybe got a little complacent. And I hope we get to see planets like that again in Star Wars, but just not all green screen. And it's doable. I mean, Blade Runner did it.
Yeah, and it's you know, there is like this give and take, and I think they did build a lot of models. I think they did build a lot of practical effects for Revenge of the Sith, but I think a lot of it is, and it's true for all those films. Like there was a lot of like compositing and like, you know, filming this actor on a green screen and then putting them into a miniature set or whatever. Like that was the case for the Geonosis Arena. Like that was a model. And then they put all the actors kind of in it on a who was on a stage, and there's kind of back and forth on that. But like you can tell just like by looking for the behind the scenes pictures and even comments from some of the actors, like they were. I think George was like pushing it to the limit. Like we're gonna create a movie that there's no sets. It's just you're walking around on a green screen and then we just film it, and. That I mean, down to like the costumes for like the clone troopers, not a single clone trooper piece of armor was created for any of these films. Doesn't exist because they were all CG, and it's impressive. It's mighty impressive, and it's impressive that this movie, yes, in places, you know, it shows. I think a lot of it does look really, really good. I think it aged really well. I think a lot of CG doesn't age very well. I think all three prequels pretty well. The CG looks really good still. I think even Phantom Menace I think looks fantastic, even 20 years on, which is literally celebrating 20 years this weekend. But you can still there is that aesthetic, and there is a lot of shots that just don't work CG wise, and it sucks, and it sucks that you don't have sets or you don't have the clone troopers or whatever because you can't tell that you know. Especially in Attack of the Clones, there's some eye lines that are off. Like you can tell actors are like looking in a different area. They're looking at a chest of a clone trooper instead of the eyes because there's nobody there to look at on set. It's just nuts.
Agreed.
Well, in spite of all that, we do still seem to enjoy this movie, don't we?
It's great.
Second favorite Star Wars film ever.
Okay, I'm just gonna throw this out there. I feel like we need to kind of we don't have a lot of time tonight, unfortunately, because of technical difficulties and whatever. But I want to give Sage enough time to talk about it. Sage, do you have a favorite moment from this movie? Is there a one particular scene that just sticks out to you?
My favorite moment in all Star Wars: Anakin versus Obi-Wan. I know some people think that it's too calculated and choreographed, and you know my point to that is one: this is the Jedi in their prime. And two, there is no two Jedi and or Sith you could pit up against each other that know each other as well as these two. So it should almost feel choreographed. I love it. It's my favorite moment in the entire saga. The fight between them is so... I mean, even though we knew how it was going to end, it's overwhelming. And the musical score by John Williams done it is another fantastic piece. But like... Ewan and Hayden worked on this fight, just their fight, for 6 months. 6 months of practice.
That's insane.
It's crazy.
And it shows. It really does. Like, you can definitely throw the, it's too long, there's too much to it, it's too extravagant, whatever. Is it the longest sword fight?
I'm pretty sure it's the longest sword fight in cinematic history.
Wow.
I'd have to Google it.
That wouldn't surprise me, honestly, because that's crazy. But like, you can throw all those criticisms out of it, but ultimately, it is astoundingly awesome to watch, and just how they pulled it off, and how it's like, yeah, a lot of it's CG, but it's really good looking CG, and the way they present it, and just the choreography and thing. Yeah, it's fast, it's intense, but it's just beautiful. And yeah, that score, Battle of the Heroes, is... I feel like people talk about it all the time. I feel like it's still underrated as a score because it's so good.
Oh, I love it. I mean, there's pieces in the sequel trilogy that I do like, but I'm not sure. I think Williams' most recent best work is still in Revenge of the Sith.
I'm not going to disagree with you there.
Hmm. Interesting.
It is indeed the longest sword fight in Galactic history.
Wow. That is impressive. Most impressive.
Even longer than the sparring duel that happened during Princess Bride.
They did it. I wonder if George Lucas knew that. He's like, yeah, Zach, do you have a favorite moment?
Whew, boy. I think, considering it was the first time we ever saw something like this on the big screen, I really, really enjoyed seeing a character that was wielding 4 lightsabers.
Grievous. Say what you will about Grievous. Again, a lot of people have a lot of different opinions. Grievous is an incredible design.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the concept, the design, the execution is just... it's bonkers. It is so George Lucas, because he's the only person that would do something that crazy and that awesome.
Well, I mean, it's been building up a little bit, because we have, you know, saber versus saber kind of situation. And then Darth Maul kicks it up a notch with a double-bladed saber. And now you've got a cybernetically enhanced being who can wield 4 lightsabers. And to use the sabers of fallen Jedi, it made a blue and green look versus a blue in Obi-Wan's lightsaber. And in my opinion, it's almost like a type of foreshadowing to a fight between 2 other Jedi sabers that's going to happen later on in the movie.
Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah, I love the foreshadowing there. I love just that whole dynamic of, you know, and Grievous is such a... he's such an interesting character because he's not a Jedi, he's not a Force user, but yet he's has this reputation and is able to hold his own against Jedi, even though he loses an arm or two.
Well, I mean, we see in the Clone Wars that he holds his own, but then even in this movie, he holds his own and pretty much has Obi-Wan right where he wants him until he gets blasted in the chest, which is something that you would never expect Obi-Wan to do, because as far back as 1977, he is called the lightsaber the more elegant weapon for a more civilized age. And, you know, after he kills Grievous and he tosses the blaster aside, you hear him say, "So uncivilized." He can't stand that's how he just won this battle. But it was literally like a fight to the finish. It was tooth and nail. It was very... I almost see it as like a Star Wars version of Brienne versus the Hound. Because after a while, Brienne and the Hound aren't using their swords anymore. They're using whatever materials they have available. So Grievous is using a saber staff and Obi-Wan's using a blaster. At one point, I think Brienne is using like a rock, and she they're just fighting for survival. And I feel like that's what it was between Grievous and Obi-Wan there at the end as well. And so it was a fight to the finish, and it showed...
it's a very scrappy fight.
Yes.
And it reminds me of like Raiders, like Indiana Jones style fights, which is intentional because the scene, or at least the chase scene, was directed by Steven Spielberg.
Was it really?
Mm-hmm.
I knew that Steven got involved in this movie a little bit, but I had forgotten at which parts.
Yes, he had a whole day as the director.
And that was the day that George was dressed up for his cameo appearance, probably.
Maybe so.
It's like, okay, I'm going to go in front of the camera now, so I'm going to let my good buddy Steven be the one behind the camera. We don't have George Lucas, but we got Steven Spielberg. Okay, I can work with that.
Yeah, who was directing? Yeah, who was directing when George was in the blue Pepinota makeup? Or I don't know, maybe George just has that kind of power. He was doing that, or maybe he called in his good buddy Steven. Maybe you're right.
I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. It would not Surprise me. So, Ben, what about you? What's a sequence of yours that you enjoy a lot?
I'm not just copping out here and saying what's first come to mind. I legitimately, that whole scene from, you know, the moment Obi-Wan jumps down and says, "Hello there." And then you have the fight and the whole chase scene is just so Star Wars. It's so, and it's just, again, what George does with these films and tries so hard to be, give something different. We've seen chase scenes. We've never seen a chase scene between a lizard and a giant wheel bike. It's something just completely bonkers out of the blue, like weird and awesome, and it's so well done. And, you know, you're getting these two characters who are fighting lightsabers, and, oh, by the way, they don't have their lightsabers anymore, and they have to just freaking, you know, beat the crap out of each other, or better yet, fry each other with a blaster. So, yeah, it's, that scene is one of my favorite sequences in the entire movie.
Can I put in a request for an honorable mention?
Sure.
I for one, am also a really big fan of the Battle of Kashyyyk.
That is great. You are not wrong there.
I love that it's the Wookiees that are the first line of defense. They want to be the warriors out on the front lines defending their homes, which I respect the hell out of. And now that we've seen in The Force Awakens just how strong the bowcasters are, we know that those things were causing some damage. And then to have the reinforcements coming out of the canopies and shooting kind of in like a cross formation, if you will, like, it was great strategy for one. And they had a really good line of defense because the droids were kind of coming at them in like a very straight form across the water there. And they were able to use the brush, they were able to use the beach as like their line of defense. It was really well, like, strategically thought out. And then bringing in Wookiee like assassins, if you will, to plant bombs on some of the walkers as they're coming up out of the water and things like that. Like, they thought of everything for those few minutes there that made the Wookiees feel empowered, made us feel like Yoda was a great strategian, and gave us some different aspects of clone armor and things like that. Like, there were a lot of things going on in those few seconds there, and they were fun to watch.
Yeah, it, you know, I, one thing I love is the fact that, you know, we kind of almost got Wookiees in Return of the Jedi, and, you know, there was that whole tease, and we got Ewoks, and I love Ewoks, but I think also Wookiees would have been better. And I love that George was like, hey, let's bring this back around and actually, like, we're gonna do, you know, Wookiees for real this time and give them, you know, it's not a huge sequence, but it's an important sequence, and, you know, it doesn't have a lot of bearing on the plot, but it is, puts that thing and, you know, establishes the connection between Yoda and Chewbacca, which all makes a lot of sense. They're two species that live really long, so heck yeah, they're going to know each other. They're going to hang out because all their human friends die every couple hundred years.
Such a depressing thought.
It's kind of funny. Back when Revenge of the Sith was being made, you know, the wait from the end of Attack of the Clones and, you know, the happy wedding and all that to the next movie felt like forever for me. You know, you're going through your teenage years. And I remember I got a Star Wars Insider membership. So I was getting the monthly magazines mailed. And part of I had that. And I had, I think it was called Hyperspace back then. I don't know if they still have that or not. It might be extinct by now. But they had an on-set camera during the filming of Revenge of the Sith. Now, you didn't see the set. It, you know, was staring off and showing a bunch of the behind the scenes people. But I specifically remember there sitting there till I had sometimes watching, hoping I could just see a glimpse of anything. And I remember one day it just, oh, there's a guy in a Wookiee costume. There's a guy in a Wookiee costume. Oh, there's another guy in a Wookiee costume. Okay, so we're getting Wookiees.
Oh my gosh. That, why don't they do stuff like that nowadays?
Like, I wish they would just have it staring offset somewhere, you know? I'd still pay for it. I'd do it. I'm that guy.
That would be amazing. I remember that. I don't remember actually watching it, but I remember it existing and like, wow, that's, you know, just being able to just have that little thing into the set. And that another, like, one of those whimsical things with George Lucas, that he was just like, he wasn't one of these that were just obsessed with security and keeping the secret. Just like, hey, we're making a movie. Yeah, you can just come in and watch some of it.
if I could take a second to mention an honorable scene here, it would be the the Obi-Wan Padme scene towards the end of the movie, where I think a lot of people perceive Obi-Wan to be uptight and strict to the Jedi code and all that. And you find out that's not the case in that scene, and that he's probably known about them for quite a while and has just kept it to himself. And I thought that was just a real stand-up thing. It's heartbreaking at the end because she knows he's going to kill him. but to find out that, you know, he's known, was cool. I'm glad it wasn't like the spur of the moment. Oh, so this happened. You know, it's clear he's known for a while, and I like the way that it was delivered on screen.
Yeah, I love the fact that you have this secret relationship between Anakin and Padme. And then, of course, you know, this movie kind of establishes, hey, Obi-Wan probably knew the whole time. And then Clone Wars, you know, introduces Ahsoka, like, yeah, Ahsoka probably knew the whole time. And then in the comics, they're like, all of her handmaidens apparently know it's a thing. So, like, kind of the best-kept secret in the galaxy.
Keeping up with the Skywalkers. That's what they need to call it.
Pretty much.
Let's talk about their relationship for a little bit here, because it's kind of the central point that everything else stems from once you get past another happy landing. Pretty much everything else that transpires is going down because Anakin can't bear the thought of losing Padme the way he lost his mother.
Mm-hmm.
That dream that he had, he takes his dreams very seriously. You know what that boy needs? He needs a freaking dream catcher. He needs to hang it over his bed wherever he sleeps and let them get caught up in those so that they don't actually make it to him, because anytime he has a dream, he acts on it and gets very impulsive and emotional about it. And it happens here again, where he's basically got this horrible, horrible tunnel vision where the only thing that he sees is Padme. And he sees her dying, and he can't stand the thought of that. I don't think it helped matters much that Yoda basically told him that he needs to get rid of his attachments, and that includes being attached to people. Because after that, he was like, well, the Jedi are no help, so I'm screwed.
The Anakin's... I mean, this is the whole thing with him, you know, and it comes to head in this movie. Is his obsession and his, you know, his fear of loss and his, you know, what he experienced in the last movie. He's determined to not let that happen again. He's put all of his chips down in Padme. And is banking on, you know, and like, I can't live without her, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, he's doomed to failure at that point. He's doomed because she's doomed. Everything he does, you know, it's basically the whole thing with time travel. Like, you know, you see something that happens in the future. Well, it's going to happen, and everything you do is just going to lead you to making it happen. And that's exactly what Anakin does.
Imagine if he, like, did want to invent time travel or something like that. Do you think that in all those years of the Death Star's construction, you know, 15, 20 years, yes, he's working on clearing up, you know, the remaining Jedi, but then in his spare time when he's going from system to system, he's got to be doing something. Meditating, probably. Healing, perhaps. But wouldn't it be funny if it was, like, also revealed that he was trying to figure out how to come up with a system for time travel so he can go back and erase everything that happened?
Well, it's funny.
Go ahead,
Sean. Yeah. Doing air quotations, the comics that are canon, I guess they're canon, they reveal that he indeed is looking for a way to bring Padme back. So,
and with Rebels, essentially it introduces time travel with the World Between Worlds. For anyone who is not familiar with that, like, it's basically a doorway you go through, and you can go through other doorways, and there are other places in time and space that you can go to. So essentially, that is the way you could do it, and it was the thing that Sidious was going after, which is could play into Rise of Skywalker. I won't go any further with that, but, you know, it's also, you can imagine, you know, that Vader, at when he, what he does in this film, you know, he lives with it for the rest of his life, and it's, he lives the entirety of the rest of his life regretting this and hating himself. And, you know, it's not until Luke comes along and Leia and show up and say, hey, you know, maybe my life isn't so bad, that, you know, there is someone else besides Padme in the galaxy that I can still love.
Somebody else worth living for and worth dying for.
Absolutely.
But we're getting ahead of ourselves talking about this other movie when we should be talking about this one.
Well, let's get to Jedi in a few episodes.
Yeah, I mean, little bit further down the line there.
Both the Jedis.
The big reveal.
Yeah.
You know, Palpatine is Darth Sidious.
So, okay, as kids, did you guys ever think that Palpatine wasn't Sidious?
No, not me anyway.
I mean, I feel like I had some inclination, mostly because his voice just sounded very familiar.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, the confirmation was still fascinating to watch unfold on the screen, because Anakin's first response isn't, teach me. It's, ignite the lightsaber and prepare to defend myself. And Palpatine's just sitting there like, yeah, go ahead, dude. Give in to this anger, because that's going to be what ends up turning you. And in what little bit of wisdom he's got left, he decides to go to the council. And here's something that gets to me that I only figured out maybe like a year ago, thanks to like a Tumblr forum or whatever. Do you guys subscribe to the theory that the reason Mace told Anakin to wait in the council chambers was because he was planning on, like, granting him the rank of master after they arrested Palpatine?
No, I think I'm going to be careful with my words here. Mace Windu's a bit of a dickhead who never liked Anakin. And I think he makes that pretty clear several times. And he wanted him nowhere. He didn't trust him. He told Obi-Wan the same thing earlier in the film, and Yoda. He didn't want Anakin anywhere near there.
Yeah, I think he kept him away because obviously Anakin is in a volatile state, and he's doing kind of everything he can to kind of keep him out of that situation. Obviously, what's interesting, and I don't necessarily subscribe to the theory that he was going to make him a master at that point, but Mace does say, if what you've told me is true, you will have gained my trust.
Exactly.
So that's, at the very least, it's a vote of confidence from Mace, who, you know, even going back to the Clone Wars, like, they've never been on the same page. Like, Mace is not a fan of Anakin. You know, he never was. And, you know, that may be of, if everything had worked out all right, and everything didn't, maybe he hadn't cut off his hand and done all that kind of stuff, you could have seen, like, maybe a bond come there where Mace kind of maybe had built up a little bit of respect for Anakin for, you know, coming clean. And Anakin was trying to do the right thing. He's like, he doesn't join Palpatine right away. He's like, you're a Sith Lord. I'm going to go tell my buds with Mace Windu. And, you know, he does the right thing. It's just that, you know, Mace does the wrong thing. Keeps him out of it. Allows Palpatine to further manipulate the situation to where Anakin comes in. He's all, you know, he's, you don't have four Jedi anymore. You have one, and he's, Anakin should have been able to figure that out, but at the same time, he didn't. All he saw was a helpless Chancellor about to be killed by Mace Windu.
Yeah, by not being part of the arrest, he lost a lot of context.
Exactly.
I'd also argue if Obi-Wan and Yoda were on Coruscant at the time of this arrest, that whole thing plays out differently.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you I mean, you run the option of possibly even being able to take down Palpatine. I don't know if they could have been. I think Sidious was very powerful, but at the same time, going having all the Jedi there against him, like it's all part of his plan to have all these Jedi Masters, half the Council, two of their best, Yoda and Obi-Wan, are out of town. You know, it's perfect time for, you know, him to make his move.
Smart guy, smart enough to be back several movies later.
Yeah, he was smart enough that even when they did kill him, he didn't die, apparently. So, yeah, that story is yet to be told.
He's like a cockroach. You just can't be killed.
Valid. No, very valid.
You see him on his back. He's been thrown down a reactor. You think, oh, he's gone. Nope, he's back. He disappears again. Where is he? I'm going to tear the house apart, try to find him.
So this now deformed Chancellor / Sith Lord sends his new apprentice to the Mustafar system to get rid of the Separatists. What did it feel like? Just a little convenient to just send him directly there and massacre all of those people. I felt like there should have been Magna Guards there or something to offer a little bit of resistance. It felt like the war was ending a little too easily, but I mean, I guess that's kind of the point, because you're killing off the Jedi and you're creating your empire. You've got to further that by getting rid of the pawns you were using to be separatists in the first place, I guess.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, it's...
He's a genius.
He is. I mean, he is. He's insidious.
The phrasing that he gives to Gunray, I gotta admit, is really, really clever storytelling. He's like, when my new apprentice arrives, he will take care of you.
He didn't lie. I mean,
nope. 100% truthful. Here's the other thing. Shouldn't one of the Separatists, shouldn't like one of their leaders have recognized the legendary Anakin Skywalker when he walked through the door?
Yeah, I don't... Yeah, you wonder. I've always wondered about that, like, how they're, like... Because, like, in the Clone Wars, like, Anakin goes on, like, undercover missions. But, like, he's also supposed to be, like, this great, like, well-known hero. Like, this superstar of the Republic.
He's the eyes, ears, and voice of the Republic.
I think they're more almost like fables, where you hear stories about Anakin and Obi-Wan, these legendary generals in the Clone Wars, but, you know, it's not like they're showing live broadcasts of the war on the Holo feed for everybody at Coruscant to watch. So I'd argue that maybe they're not as well known to the public eye, and it's more of a name thing.
Yeah, and also, I mean, just he's got his hood down, and, you know, he
just
walks
killed
in the
a
room.
Bunch of kids, yellow eyes.
Yeah, they're not necessarily thinking about, oh, that's that guy, because, like, technically speaking, like, Anakin and Gunray have met at least a few times. So, like, they might recognize each other, but, like, ultimately, it's just Anakin going in there, and he's not wasting any time. You know, pull down the doors, okay, let's go, you guys are dead.
So, I have to ask you guys this, I know we're running out of time, but, I feel like there's a lot of quotable lines in this movie.
Uh-huh.
Do you guys have a favorite line in the movie?
Ooh, man.
That's a tough question.
Honestly, I'm going to go back to the beginning of the film. I'm going to go all the way back to the duel on Grievous's ship. Cuz Dooku and Anakin clash swords, and Dooku says to him, I sense great fear in you, Skywalker. You have hate, you have anger, but you don't use them. And it's almost like you could tell that that was the switch, that when he did open himself up to those things, that's when he became a bit of a loose cannon. And I think Palpatine recognized it as well, and that's why he jumped on it so quickly. And I think it's interesting that when Anakin finally did do those things, he took down Dooku almost instantly.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I just love hearing Christopher Lee talk. He could quote every line from this movie. He could say, Annie, I'm pregnant, and I would still love everything that man said.
That would be awkward. But yeah, like, entertaining
just
as hell.
Just let Christopher Lee read the entire script of the movie. And like, you're on Mustafar, and instead of Padme hugging onto him, it's Christopher Lee saying, Anakin, all I want is your love.
I immediately got the image of where Anakin and Dooku are like holding their sabers, pressing up against one another, and he says the line, you have anger, you have hate, but you don't use them. But instead of that, sub the, Annie, I'm pregnant.
That
would have been a great diversion tactic.
Somebody meme that. Like, somebody meme it.
Respond to that. Like, your sabers clash up against your mortal enemy, and then out of nowhere, he tells you, I'm pregnant.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God.
You know, it's like, okay. What? Dooku kills
you know
him.
What, you know what needs to be a meme? I need either a four-panel or a six-panel meme. I don't know which one. But I need one where they're talking, and Palpatine's like, kill him now. And Anakin's like, I know I shouldn't. And then Palpatine's like, do it. We all know that scene. We all mm-hmm. appreciate it. But there's one sequence from my favorite sitcom where somebody says, just do it, out of like this challenge or what have you. And This is my favorite character's response. They say, just do it, and this is it. I sent it to you guys in the Facebook chat.
Oh, my. Oh, my.
What is this? That's gold.
Come on, load, Facebook.
Because that's basically what happens. Is you're like, oh, just do it. And then all of a sudden...
Oh, I'm convinced.
I'm convinced. Like, all you needed was to say, do it. And apparently that was enough to convince them to do it. But I'm just a huge fan of the show Friends, so I may be a little biased there.
Does Ben have a favorite line? Or did he say his?
Oh, he didn't say his. I'm sorry.
Favorite line. It's hard. I'm not gonna say any particular line, but I love the whole exchange at the opera, and I love the whole back and forth, especially at this point in time when you have Anakin pretty much sticking up for the Jedi and Palpatine kind of going like, trying to undermine him, like, yeah, you know, the power, you know, that Jedi are you know, trying to get power. All who gain power are afraid to lose it, even the Jedi, and kind of putting Anakin kind of on the spot to kind of like defend the Jedi, but also simultaneously undermining his teachings and kind of putting him on the defensive, and then of course making Anakin think, yeah, maybe the Jedi aren't as good as I think they are. Maybe the Sith aren't as bad as I've made them out to be. So it's just a masterfully, like, for everyone that hates on Hayden Christensen or whatever, like, the guy has some great scenes, and that's one of them. And Ian McDermott too.
If I had one, it comes from Padme, and
really,
it comes from Padme, and it's when the Republic's being turned into the new Galactic Empire, and it's this is how liberty dies, with thunderous applause. And I've always loved that line. I remember on the old MSN Messenger, I had that as like my quote beside my name for like 2 months.
Man, you're really dating yourself. I talk about MSN Messenger. You're really dating the heck out of yourself. There's one fight that we still haven't touched on. I mean, we touched on the Battle of Heroes for just a second there, but you know, simultaneously, there's a fight happening in the Senate chambers, which mm-hmm. compared to the Battle of Heroes. It makes it look completely live action. because you've got the rotundas being thrown around. You've got a tiny little CGI character jumping around all over the place. I dare say that's probably some of the most CGI I see in the whole film. I felt really bad for Ian McDiarmid.
Yeah, that whole scene doesn't get enough attention. And just the fact that it's literally the destruction of the Senate, and the fact that you had this kind of iconic location that's been established, and now it's in shambles, and you have this giant lightsaber duel. You didn't realize like how great of a venue, I should say, for a lightsaber duel that was, and how like democracy is failing, and this empire is taken over, and the Sith are literally just destroying the Senate.
My favorite part about that battle is probably, I know everybody wants, and this is just my personal take on it, everybody wants to go, oh, well, Yoda, even with one, and I view it more as Yoda gotten a few shots and probably had a couple of opportunities where he could have killed him, but as soon as they get in the set and there's no longer lightsaber battle, the battle is over. Palpatine is just tossing, platform after platform after platform at Yoda with ease, and it takes Yoda quite a bit just to toss them at him. And Palpatine, Sidious, whatever, the Emperor, like him or not, in my opinion, is on a whole nother level even than Yoda.
I don't think Palpatine is evenly matched. I don't think anyone is evenly matched with Palpatine in this movie, whether they met Palpatine or not. I think Mace Windu is out of his depth. I think Palpatine was mostly toying with him in that battle. And he could have killed him at any time. He just needed him to look defenseless in front of Anakin. And then you have Yoda, who I think should be as powerful. But I think, again, I think Yoda's powers are stunted. I think he's been kind of, the wool's been pulled over his eyes. Or the dark side has been pulled over his eyes, more accurately. And he's, as you said, in that fight, he's outmatched. Like, Palpatine is getting the best. Even though he knocks Palpatine out and he's hanging on, which is borderline hilarious when you see the look on Palpatine's face when Yoda creates that force bubble between them and then it blows them to opposite sides of the car.
The right guy won the fight.
Oh, absolutely.
So here's my gripe. And it's kind of a small gripe, but it's one that I've always been curious about. Because Coruscant isn't exactly a hop, skip, and a jump away from Mustafar. Why did two members of the Jedi Council have to split up and meet one Sith each, other than for story purposes?
I don't think Yoda wanted Obi-Wan anywhere near the Emperor.
But you have a better chance when the odds are 2-1.
They definitely... The way Palpatine just sliced through Kit Fisto and all those other guys, I don't think Obi-Wan stood a chance. I think realistically, just for a story reason, I think it was like they're running out of time and they have to take out both of them now. And also, the Jedi are overconfident and they're blinded. And so, of course, Yoda's going to be like, okay, yeah, Obi-Wan, you go kill Anakin, I'll kill Palpatine. We got this. No, they don't. Like, they were never going to happen. And whether, two against one would have been better or not, I think they were doomed to start with.
I don't disagree that it was a lost cause either way. But the funny thing is, since we see both of these characters in A New Hope, we know that nothing super serious is going to happen to either of them. Neither of them get maimed or deformed or anything like that. Both of them go into exile for one reason or another, and we actually see Darth Vader become who we see in the original trilogy. I don't know about you guys, but that whole sequence that was like the birth of the kids and the rebirth of Darth Vader, the mirroring and the parallels that are being shown there is actually probably some of the best storytelling in that whole trilogy, in my opinion.
Super emotional.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's great.
The way I see it is not only are you showing the birth of new characters and the rebirth of the villain that everybody has come to know and love and fear, but you're also using your current movie to set the stage for events that are going to be happening in quote-unquote future movies that have already transpired. This is the genius of George Lucas, some of the underrated genius, is that this movie simultaneously wraps up the events that happened during Attack of the Clones and the Clone Wars, and finds a way to tie things together to A New Hope.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is the bridge between one series and another. And not only did it deliver great action sequences, some we didn't even get to talk about, but it also delivers some really compelling storytelling that gets you engaged in what's currently going on and helps you better understand what's going to happen in movies like A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah. And it's the whole ending scene for me, I think, is one of my favorite sequences, because it is this wrap up and this kind of like, it is this homecoming for like bringing it back around. And it was just amazing to see that for the first time back in 2005, because, you know, we thought that was the ending, and it felt like a perfectly good ending for the saga, because we had come full circle. We'd, you know, come, you know, A New Hope to Jedi, and we thought that was it. Now they're making prequels. We got, you know, Phantom Menace all the way to Revenge of the Sith, and it brought it back around A New Hope, and it was perfect. I'm glad it wasn't, but, you know, it's that whole ending scene and the whole, you know, seeing the Death Star and the delivery of the twins, and it's just so heartwarming. And it's a great cap on a very rocky and a very dark film.
The moment where Obi-Wan delivers Luke, biased moment here for me, Obi-Wan's my favorite, but that was so powerful and emotional, and just absolutely loved it. And I mean, Ewan's just so great. Like, you can see on his face while he's in thought, like, dude's clearly heartbroken as it gets after what's just transpired.
Mm-hmm. And I love that moment when he gives her Luke and she walks away, and he just kind of stands there for a second and he kind of watches her walk away, and then he just slowly turns around and walks away. Gives me chills every time, because it's like, it's just this small but very poignant moment, because, you know, last time we see Ewan McGregor is Obi-Wan, of course, you know, out of universe, but also, you know, the next time we see him, it'll be 20 years, you know, he'll be saying hello there again, but he'll be much older and a much different time. It just hits me in the feels.
I mean, if we never get an Obi-Wan TV show or movie featuring Ewan, I'm glad that that's the final time we see Ewan as Obi-Wan. It's top notch.
I'm hoping that we get something while the man is still in his prime, you know?
But hopefully. We'll see.
It's such an outside shot now, unfortunately, considering all the other stuff that you're going to be getting on Disney Plus.
Oh, I'd say it's about 50-50 after Iger's comments the other day.
Oh, who knows?
Well, no, we shall see.
Goodness gracious.
So, I just went back through our log of IPC episodes. Our show notes log. Do you know when we last discussed Revenge of the Sith?
I honestly have no idea.
Oh, I want to guess this.
Bear in mind, this is episode 238, and we discussed this movie back in 2015 in preparation for The Force Awakens.
You know what? That's the first time that you and I met. I was either on for, I'm pretty sure I was on for Revenge of the Sith. I think I was on for Empire. I lived at like my old place with my ex a long time ago. I didn't even have my dog at that point. And I was walking around the city while on air with you guys. It was first time I'd ever met Zach, so it's either that one or one of the ones that you did leading up to The Force Awakens, but I knew it was 2015.
It says that our guest for that episode was the Wastelands crew and Eric Wall.
There you go.
Wow.
So that very well could be. And to answer one of your previous questions that you had off the air, Ben, the last time we discussed this movie, we tried to do the quote-a-thon.
Oh.
Which did not go very well. It was quite the cluster, if I remember correctly.
Well, we have tried it recently. Also didn't go so well.
No. We do not speak of that. That was a failed attempt. So,
you know what? We never actually decided on what quote to do. I have a few lined up.
Let's just do all of them.
I'm fine with that, but we're going to have to run through.
We'll be here all night. No, I'm kidding, man.
I trust your judgment because, like we were talking about, there are so many great quotable scenes from this movie. So I'll just shut up and give it over to the actual people who said the actual lines and present to you, ladies and gentlemen, tonight's quote of the night.
You wanted to see me, Chancellor?
Yes, Anakin, come closer. I have good news. Our clone intelligence units have discovered the location of General Grievous. He's hiding in the Utapau system.
At last, we'll be able to capture that monster and end this war.
I would worry about the collective wisdom of the Council who didn't select you for this assignment. Not the best choice, by far. Sit down. Leave us. Anakin, you know I'm not able to rely on the Jedi Council. If they haven't included you in their plot, they soon will.
I'm not sure I understand.
You must sense what I have come to suspect. The Jedi Council want control of the Republic. They're planning to betray me.
I don't think
that... Anakin. Search your feelings. You know, don't you?
I know they don't trust you.
Or the Senate. Or the Republic. Or democracy, for that matter.
I have to admit, my trust in them has been shaken.
Why? They asked you to do something that made you feel dishonest, didn't they? They asked you to spy on me, didn't they?
I don't know what to say.
Remember back to your early teachings. All who gain power are afraid to lose it, even the Jedi.
The Jedi use their power for good.
Good is a point of view, Anakin. The Sith and the Jedi are similar in almost every way, including their quest for greater power.
The Sith rely on their passion for their strength. They think inwards, only about themselves.
And the Jedi don't.
The Jedi are selfless. They only care about others.
You ever hear the tragedy of Darth Plagueis the Wise?
No.
I thought not. It's not a story the Jedi would tell you. It's a Sith legend. Darth Plagueis was a dark lord of the Sith,
so powerful and so wise, he could use the Force to influence the midichlorians to create life. He had such a knowledge of the dark side, he could even keep the ones he cared about from dying.
He could actually save people from death.
The dark side of the Force is a pathway to many abilities some consider to be unnatural.
What happened to him?
He became so powerful. The only thing he was afraid of was losing his power, which eventually, of course, he did. Unfortunately, he taught his apprentice everything he knew. Then his apprentice killed him in his sleep. It's ironic. He could save others from death, but not himself.
Is it possible to learn this power?
Not from a Jedi.
Such a memorable sequence, and the way that they finish that and cut to the next scene, you're like, I want to know what he says next. You know, like, I hate those types of conversations where the editors cut out the rest of the sequence, cut out the rest of the conversation, because you know that there had to have been other topics of conversation after that. Like, the opera wasn't over yet. So they had to have kept talking a little bit, and you're going to finish with that line, and then Anakin's just kind of sitting there like, oh, so do you like popcorn?
I'm pretty sure if the conversation kept going, it would have just been like Anakin going, so you're a Sith Lord, aren't you? Like, this thing, this, you're too obvious about this. You're a Sith Lord, dude.
I think it probably would have been more along the lines of, the hell was the deal with that Papanoia guy out there?
Probably could have been. Could have been. But, guys, I know that we promised, like, a more condensed episode tonight, and so we need to stay true to our word. Let's do final thoughts in a bit of a different way. Let's do final thoughts on the Anakin versus Obi-Wan fight and the implications that it has on the movie, and then do our planet score.
Okay.
Is that fair? Because I feel like we need to give a little bit of time to that, but we're also running out of time, so I think that's a good way to blend the two. Sage, you're the guest on the show, so we'll toss it to you first. Your thoughts on Anakin versus Obi-Wan and your planet score for this movie as a whole?
Well, I'm not going to lie. I'm not sure I know how to do the planet score.
It's just the decimal point rating out of 10 like we do on Call the Banners.
You have to go outside and count the planets that you can see, and then you give a score on that. No, I'm just kidding.
I'll get back to you never. The fight is amazing. It's my favorite of all time. That includes any movie and or TV show. And, I mean, it's pretty simple mistake that it has for the movie and what it means. If Obi-Wan loses, that's it. There's no more. Because Anakin will have Padme. You know, it doesn't matter if Yoda escaped. You know, good for Yoda. But if Obi-Wan loses the fight, that's it.
That's a good point. Like, the fact that it's kind of a fight over Padme. Because whoever wins that, you know, takes her. And, you know, if Anakin got to her, that's a different original trilogy.
Who knows how that would have ended up. I'm going to give this movie, it's my second favorite Star Wars movie, just ahead of The Force Awakens and just behind The Empire Strikes Back, so I'm giving this 9.9.
Goodness. Whoa. That's going to stagger the scores just a little bit there.
Two favorite movies Empire and Revenge of the Sith.
Dang, that is awesome. Ben, implications for this fight and your score for the movie?
It's a fight for everything. I mean, and it's funny how this fight, being that, you know, how these films were released, it's in the middle, smack dab in the middle of the saga, but yet it is this climactic thing that, you know, makes a difference for everything. You know, if you know, and also the fact that no one dies in this fight. Like, you know, you could say figuratively Anakin dies here and Vader comes out, but, you know, physically, literally, you know, not a single person. There's no stakes as far as, like, who's going to die. We know both of these people live to fight another day, quite literally. But it's just in a magnificent thing that, you know, comes down to, you know, I know, yeah, people will criticize it for whatever things. I think it's a great fight that it shows, like, how well and even these guys are matched to each other. And it's just such a magnificent fight. And then come to that moment that you were the chosen one. You were supposed to be balanced the force, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, Ewan McGregor acting the frickin' hell out of it. And just some of the best Star Wars dialogue ever. And if you can watch that scene and not cry, you're a better person than I am. You're a stronger will person than I am, because that is a tearjerker. And it's just so amazing. And like I said, the score is great. The visual effects are great. Everything, the choreography, I love me some choreography. And it's some of the best. It is the best choreography, best choreographed fight in the entire saga. And overall, for the film, I'm gonna give it a 9.
Alrighty. Interesting. Alright, coming into tonight, I had been thinking about giving it something along the lines of an 8.5 to an 8.8. But here's what I've come to realize is, in addition to all the action and the choreography and everything else, the CGI, whatever it may be, there's actually some really great storytelling that happens in this movie as well. And to me, it feels like that is just so effectively pronounced during this exchange between Anakin and Obi-Wan. Because he acts out of anger rather than relief when he sees his old master. He's enraged at his presence at all. He thinks that, you know, the one person that matters to him the most is turning against him and falling out of love with him, and he's not willing to accept the fault for that. His first thought is to blame somebody else. He's playing the victim card like you would not believe. And throughout the whole fight, he's blaming everyone but himself. He's blaming Obi-Wan, he's blaming Padme, he's blaming the Jedi, calling them evil. And at one point, Obi-Wan calls him out on it, and he's like, "You're lost. You're so lost." But he doesn't really make an appeal like, "Come back," the way Padme does. Obi-Wan's realized that he's gone. He's so far gone that he can't be redeemed. The only thing that can be done is that he needs to be stopped. And it's a fight to the death. And you can tell during certain sequences that they are running out of energy, that they are tired, they are on fumes, but they're still going at it. And yes, it's a fight for Padme, it's a fight for the galaxy, it's a fight for, you know, the Empire versus democracy. There's all these different things that it's a struggle for. And in the end, I feel like it actually kind of plays out to a bit of a draw. Because Anakin's still alive and Obi-Wan's still alive. Anakin slash Vader now gets to rise to power. Obi-Wan has to go into hiding. So even though he may have won the physical altercation, it didn't change anything. It didn't really change the shape of the galaxy. It didn't really change the outcome of the situation. Padme still died, the Empire still rose, and Vader became the Emperor's right-hand man. So I feel like those kinds of things would have happened regardless of who won. things still played out the way that they needed to. But like you said, the choreography was absolutely breathtaking. And it's one of my favorite planets to fight on during Battlefront. So that's a little added bonus and a small callback to the video game. I think I prefer playing on Utapau because of the strategy involved of the left flank versus the right flank, but I digress.
I tell you what, if you do Battlefront, and some of us still do, if you have Battlefront 2, the original Battlefront 2, go in, turn off, you can turn off AI, and just turn on heroes, and go in, you can recreate the Mustafar fight with just your heroes, Anakin and Obi-Wan.
You know, so it's kind of funny being Anakin or Obi-Wan on Mustafar, though, and coming up to some random droid or clone trooper and just continuously force pushing them until you push them into the lava.
It's the best.
The stories we could tell from the Battlefront days. Probably best saved for another day, though. My point being, I came in wanting to give it an 8.5 to an 8.8, but I think I'm going to join you guys in the ranks of the Nines world. This is third place for me behind Empire and Rogue One. But it is slowly creeping up because I think I had The Force Awakens ahead of it at one point, but I think I may have had to flip those at some point. So I think if I'm actually putting this ahead of The Force Awakens would probably be around a 9, and Rogue One's probably around a 9.5, so that means I'm going to have to give Revenge of the Sith a 9.2. Put it right down the middle.
Mm-hmm. So we've 9.25.
No, 9.2. I'm not going to mess with the numbers that much because we all know from Phantom Fraternity what happens when we do that. So a 9.2, a 9.9, and a 9. 28.1 out of a possible 30 points. That's a 93.6% score from the hosts tonight. And if you have a planet score that you want to submit to us on social media, just go find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at IPC Podcast and let us know. If you're listening live on Channel 1138, go ahead and send that to us. I know that there's quite a few of you that are listening live tonight. Thank you very much for tuning in live with us. And send it to us there as well. But Sage, I know that it's kind of a late night and that's partially my fault. So apologies for keeping you up later than we promised we would. But thank you for being on with us. Thank you for talking Revenge of the Sith. Where can the folks at home keep up with you if they wanted to hear some other material of yours?
Well, I mean, the Game of Thrones series finale is Sunday.
Yep.
And we're going to be live on Monday reviewing it. But as I said on one of our Wednesday shows, I might go live on Fandom Cantina after it airs just to get out some, I'm assuming what's going to be not necessarily frustration, but just exhaustion. I don't know. So stay tuned for a post about that. Maybe it'll happen. Maybe it won't. Otherwise, Zach, myself, McMahon, and who knows who else will be live on Monday breaking down the finale. And that's at 9 p.m. Eastern on the Phantom Cantina.
Nice. Well, dude, I'm looking forward to that. I'm not looking forward to the series wrapping up, and I'm not looking forward to that being one of the final episodes of the podcast that we've got going on, at least until the prequel rears its head. But looking forward to that, and had a lot of fun tonight. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. And Zach, I mean this with the utmost respect. I think I have a new favorite Arnold after this week. Have a good one.
A new favorite Arnold?
What is that supposed to mean?
Oh, Zach knows what it means.
You talking Schwarzenegger?
No. I'm talking your last name.
Oh.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, yes. Okay. That took a lot longer than it needed to. It is so damn late.
I loved every minute of it.
Ugh, so damn late. So, Ben, for context, I recorded some audio of my dad doing his first reaction to a really big scene that happened on Game of Thrones.
Oh.
And then I sent Sage the link so that he could listen to the audio. And apparently he really, really enjoyed it and now likes my dad more than me.
Precisely.
Oh my gosh.
Feeling the love, man. Feeling the love. You said that to me at the end of the episode so I wouldn't hang up on you during. I see how it is.
Exactly.
His strategy. He's like Sidious. He's dropping those hints right when the...
Chaos is the ladder. Good night, everybody.
Sean Giroux, everybody, a.k.a. Sage from the Fandom Cantina. Always a pleasure having him on, even if he is going to be a jerk to me, but whatever.
Yeah. You just gotta put up with something sometimes.
Yeah, you put up or shut up. It's one of those moments, but it is what it is. Well, since this is a somewhat condensed episode, we're not going to make you guys listen to a commercial break, but we are going to say thank you to the people that financially contribute to this podcast. People like Joey Mays, Jake Damon, Rachel Perry, Dan Grievous, and Parker Ott. You guys are the ones that are like the real MVPs. You keep the show going, and we always say thank you every week, but we always mean it every week, because without you, we would not be able to do what we do. And if you're interested in helping keep this ship afloat, we've got some added expenses that have come up. Things like Netflix increasing their cost for their subscription. Things like keeping up with Podbean on top of everything else that we're doing. We're looking at potentially traveling next year, if that's a possibility. Things like San Diego and Celebration and things like that. So if you're interested in helping us do the things that we really, really would like to do and the things that we really, really need to do, then go find us at ipcpodcast.podbean.com. There's a Become a Patron link that you can follow there. And you can also get access to every episode that we've ever produced, all 230 plus episodes that we've done over the last 5 freaking years. It's all there at ipcpodcast.podbean.com, and we got several hundred episodes on places like StarWarsUnderworld.com, iTunes, Google Play, CastBox, and the like. The only place that we're not on is like YouTube and SoundCloud, but maybe we need to work on that. Who knows?
Yeah, we do.
We'll get to
certainly.
That.
We'll get to that eventually, but we're not there yet. But the place that we are at is a long, long-standing sequence that has been a part of this podcast for years, literally years. Ben, I realized earlier today, and I tagged you on Facebook with it, but I realized after talking about our 5-year anniversary last year that we've done 237, now 238 episodes in the last 260 weeks, which is 52 weeks times 5 years, that's 260 weeks. So 260 minus 237 is 23. In the last 5 years, there have only been 23 weeks where an episode of IPC did not air.
Wow.
And that means there's only 23, maybe 24, 25 times when this segment has not aired in the last 5 years. So odds are we may be rehashing some old material. After 230-something odd episodes, it's bound to happen. But it's time to talk about it again. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, get out your hashtags and start putting them in the chat if you're listening live. Put them on social media. Find us at IPC Podcast on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, because we do check that hashtag. And we may be doing that again sometime soon. But for now, it's time, one more time, for hashtag BBQ Watch.
Barbecue. Barbecue.
Barbecue. Barbecue. Barbecue.
Barbecue. Barbecue. Barbecue. Barbecue.
Barbecue. Barbecue sauce. Barbecue sauce.
Barbecue. 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 Barbecue.
Barbecue. Watch.
May the barbecue be with you.
Okay, so this one's kind of twofold. First one's going to be Star Wars related. How cool would a barbecue on Mustafar be?
Okay, here's my question to you.
Mm-hmm.
Could you cook something over lava?
I feel like the lava would consume it, wouldn't it? I mean, it consumes metal.
Maybe so. I don't know. I've always, like, you know, like, anybody that, like, in real life goes into a volcano, he has to wear, like, one of those protective suits, like, just to even get close. Like, it is extremely hot. So you're probably right. The thing, like, I don't know, could you get, like, within a safe distance? Like, you get on right on the edge of the thing? You know, maybe a mile away? I don't know. You know, could you somehow harness that heat to cook something? I don't know. Like, frying an egg on a sidewalk?
I mean,
only with a volcano?
I feel like you could. You put it on the hot ground and you leave it there, or you get some sort of, like, holding device and hold it over the lava or the magma. But you don't, like, let it directly make contact with it. It's just within the proximity. It's close to it, but not actually touching. I think that's a possibility. I also think you could maybe extract some from the main source and then use it as, like, your heat source for a furnace or an enclosed area, and then use that enclosed area as your place to smoke or slow cook the meat. I do think it's possible, but It would have to be, like, very intentional and deliberate. Otherwise, I feel like the heat would just burn everything to a crisp, or it would catch fire the way Anakin did. Like, there's just a lot of danger involved in trying to put flesh that close to a heat source like that.
Yeah, I think you get pretty messy, and I don't know if there'd be a lot of flavor there from molten lava.
Yeah, okay, so speaking of flavor, this is the other half that's not Star Wars related, but is still kind of barbecue related. The flavor of the sauces. This is something that I feel like we've touched on before when we've found different types of sauces, or we've found, like, those package deals on Amazon that have, like, five or six different flavors from one company or what have you. But recently, I went to this barbecue place called David's, and their meat was a little on the tough side, but their sauce had a bite to it.
Oh.
Most of the time when I have sauce, it can be a little sweet sometimes, or it can be tangy, or it can be warm, but this one felt like it actually had legit spice to it. And I don't know if they put paprika in it or if they put, you know, something in it to kind of beef it up or bolster it up. But even after the sauce became room temperature, it still had a bit of a bite to it. And
yeah, there was something hot in there.
It just got me thinking about some of the different types of sauces that I've had. Because you can have the vinegar-based Carolina style, you can have the ketchup-based, the mustard-based. There's a lot of different kinds of barbecue sauces out there, and it can be used for a lot of different purposes. Case in point, I took some of the leftover sauce from my trip to David's, and I actually drizzled it on top of my cheese pizza that I cooked tonight.
Oh, wow.
Well, but that wasn't the only thing that I put on this pizza, okay? I'd had kind of a long week, and I decided I was going to treat myself. And I bought a self-rising crust, not a thin crust, and it was a stuffed crust at that. I love cheese stuffed crust pizza. I don't know if you folks at home know this, but I can't have takeout pizza. And so the best kind of pizza that I can get is, like, DiGiorno. And so I bought myself, like, a $10 DiGiorno pizza, and then I bought a whole bunch of fixins to go with it. I took that sauce from David's. I took some Valentina hot sauce. I took a can of diced black olives. And I took some bacon bits. I took some Parmesan cheese. And I took some chopped onion. And made myself, like, a super stuffed crust pizza. And I'm telling you, it's going to be my breakfast tomorrow. It's going to be my lunch tomorrow. I divvied it up in such a way that I'm going to be able to savor this for a while. But the bite from the Valentina combined with the bite from the David's barbecue sauce, I had to go and find some ranch to drizzle on top of all of that to counter it all out, because it had a lot of bite and not a lot of cooling action. But the ranch did help.
Yeah. Yeah, ranch does cool it down a bit.
So that's a question that we should probably save for another time. Maybe next week's episode could be talking about the importance of ranch when it comes to barbecue. Or does it have any importance?
That would be interesting. I would be very interested in talking about some ranchy stuff.
We're going to get ranchy here on the IPC podcast next week, folks. But until then, just be sure to follow us on social media. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Zach, Z-A-C underscore D-F-W.
You can find me at Ben Hart with no E on the Twitter and the Facebook and the Instagram.
Oh, so much fun. It's like a game of hide and seek. You gotta spell it all out. And then you actually find the guy.
Sometimes.
And I'm pretty sure, I might be mistaken, but it was you or somebody else, I feel like it was you though, that shared a petition to stop online petitions.
Yes, that was me. That was my petition to say, because there's currently a, we didn't even talk about it, there's some news out today. Really quick, Robert Pattinson has apparently been cast as the Batman in The Batman by Matt Reeves, and then it's been denied and all this kind of stuff. But people have been, you know, there's a petition to get him recast. There's a petition to remake Season 8 of Game of Thrones. And I'm like, can we just stop with the petitions already? Like, it's so dumb. It never makes any, you know, thing happen. They're not going to remake Game of Thrones. They're not going to recast Batman because this is fans said too. So, yeah, that was my petition. Yeah, go like and retweet that one. We can get it up to 1,000 likes. And, yeah, the irony will be strong with that one.
It's just, I have so many thoughts, but I also want to keep this podcast under 2 hours because I promised you that I would. So maybe those
You're doing
thoughts...
good.
Maybe those thoughts will be saved for another episode. It just means there's still more to talk about. Even after 230-something odd episodes, there's still so much more to talk about here on this podcast.
Yes, indeed. And whatever we talk about next week, it's sure to be fun. But I've enjoyed our Star Wars episodes, enjoyed coming back and talking more. And we got a bunch more of these to do throughout the rest of the year. And it's going to be a heck of a lot of fun.
This is very true. This is very true. I believe we're going in the order of the movies, not in the order of their release dates. So we might have Solo on tap next.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, we've been chronological canon order so far.
Yep.
So that would be up next.
So it would be Solo, Rogue One, and then A New Hope.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Wow, we're going straight to the new films.
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of jumping around a little bit, but it should be interesting. Be sure to jump onto channel1138.com next week when we bring you another awesome episode of the IPC podcast. But until then, we're going to call it. Episode 238 is now officially in the books. For Benjamin Hart, I'm Zach Arnold. Thank you for tuning in. We hope that you'll tune in next week. But until that time comes around, we just want to leave you with this closing thought. Those who enslave others inevitably become slaves themselves. We hope that you're a slave to this show, because then we'll get to see you next week right here on IPC. But until then, good night, everyone.